This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
That has been confirmed, but I mean, this is the kind of effect that it's going to have on the industry. One Discovery and their two largest buyers are putting holds on their orders. Japan's order was with a company that our farm sells to. Columbia Grain. So this is going to affect us if this sticks around.
And us meaning that you're in the Willamette Valley, right? And what, 250 miles away from this field?
Yes, that's right. So even though we're on the other side of the state, the company that we sell our conventional white wheat to, Columbia Grain, is currently not, their order for this Japanese company has been put on hold. So we don't know how long that's going to last, but that shows how drastic this situation is and how serious our buyers are about not wanting this stuff in their food supply.
Well, for people, and probably most of the listeners don't understand the mechanics of wheat farming and also of wheat selling. So let's talk a bit about why your shipment of wheat to Asia would be affected by another farmer who is using the same distributors you are.
Well, the biggest reason is because all of these farms, most of the farms in the Northwest that ship conventional wheat, that stuff all comes down the same channels. A lot of it comes down the Columbia River, gets shipped out through Kelso or Portland, and they have no way to separate out GMO wheat from conventional or organic wheat. All of these shipments from all these farmers get mingled together in one order, one big boat, and sent overseas to Asia. So the Japanese and the Koreans know that there's a risk that if they keep buying wheat right now that it could be contaminated with GMOs, and so they immediately put a stop to it. There's no way to separate them two, and that's why we've been saying for a long time one of the immediate effects would be a disruption of the whole wheat market in the Northwest, not just for a handful of organic growers. This affects all the wheat growers.
That's what I find very interesting about this. And I was talking to you and your employer, Harry Stalford, over the weekend about the part of me that likes to be hopeful and think, well, maybe this is the wake-up call for conventional farmers, that they're going to understand what the organic farmers have been arguing all along, that there's some truth to it. Do you think that that is actually that people are waking up, or do you think that it's going to have to get a lot worse before conventional farmers realize the real threat of GMO crops?
I think that anybody that was on the fence before is really going to see that this is serious now. People that maybe doubted that this was as serious as a lot of people were saying are now going to recognize that this will have an immediate impact on their business. So yeah, I think it is going to be the shot in the arm that the anti-GMO people need in order to say, hey, look, we were right all along. Look what's happening now. That's proved our point. So I think ultimately in the long run, this could be a very good thing for the anti-GMO movement.
But is it going to be a good thing for those of us who want to eat on the planet?
Well, I mean, immediately, no. The immediate risk is bad, and because we don't know how widely this is spread. So one of the things we're doing on our farm now is we've begun the process for testing all of our white wheat. And already in the past couple of days since this came out, some of our customers have written to us saying, well, we're really concerned about this. What are you guys doing about this? Are you going to be testing? You know, we're really concerned. And so we knew we had to take immediate action, and we needed to be proactive in testing our grain so that everybody is reassured that we don't have contaminated strains.
Well, it's kind of interesting to me. I mean, my partner Elaine Velasquez and I have working on a documentary about food justice, and we've been interviewing your employees, Harry Stalford and Willa Coberly, for about a year and a half. And the last two interviews, we spent a lot of time talking about GMOs. And Harry, as a longtime conventional grass seed farmer, is perhaps a bit more adamantly opposed to GMOs than a lot of his conventional farmer neighbors. But we've been going through this it's been more theoretical in all the conversations that we've had, though Harry keeps saying, you know, it's like you don't want basically to let the genie out of the bottle or open this giant Pandora's box or whatever other analogy you want to use. So now we're faced with all the things that we've been talking about theoretically for the last year and a half, and people have been talking about this theoretically for a lot longer than that. I wonder how you're both, specifically on your farm and then what you're seeing in the larger community, now that the theory has become a reality, what's the next step?
Well, I suppose that this does show that, I mean, the risks are so high because once this is out, it's out, and we don't know how we're going to get it back and contain it. So that's something we've been saying for a long time. Why would you approve a crop that is a major food crop for use that's genetically modified if you don't know the long-term health effects? You can't conclusively say that this is safe. You can't conclusively say that this isn't going to spread. Why would you let that out into our ecosystem? I mean, you just don't know. I mean, this isn't designed to help growers. This isn't designed to help consumers. This is designed to help the biotech companies that hold the patent and the chemicals that are sprayed on these crops. So that's the sole reason why these things are being pushed so hard. So this benefits nobody but the company that makes it. And we've been saying this for a long time, and Harry Stalford's absolutely right when he recognizes the risks of letting this stuff out of the ecosystem. Once it's out, and you can't get it back. I mean, I don't know how we're going to be able to contain it if it were approved for commercial use. They stopped field trials 10 years ago, and look what's happening. This stuff is popping up, and nobody knows how.
And what's interesting, you're saying that they shouldn't be thinking or trying to try to get it approved. Well, my understanding is Monsanto withdrew it. They recognized that there was no market for it. It wasn't that they were concerned about health and safety issues, but nobody wanted it outside of the United States, and so they pulled it from the market. They pulled their applications for approval, and they haven't been testing, I guess, anywhere for 9 years, and they've been testing in Oregon for 12 years. So in spite of the fact that it's not going to ever be approved and they stopped testing, that we still have this problem with this contamination now, what does that say about how little perhaps they know or care about what the consequences are?
I don't know that they would stop pushing for approval of it. I think that they've probably continued conversations behind closed doors about how can we get around this problem of some countries overseas that buy this crop. How can we overcome their objections to this? How can we pressure them to accept it so that these growers will start growing it? Because I believe that there's probably plenty of organizations here that would get behind GMO wheat if it were approved in other countries. They would jump all over it. And I think that's because the industry is, the pressure is coming from above, from the seed companies. I mean, I looked at a list earlier this morning of seed companies that Monsanto owns, and they own dozens of seed companies that sell all kinds of wheat and other crops. So, I mean, their fingers extend very deeply into the industry, and I don't doubt for one second that they've stopped trying to push for their GMO wheat to get approved in some level.
It has been a little quieter about it.
Exactly.
Well, I'd like to talk a bit about how this possibly can happen. It could have happened. Now, nobody knows, and you said the USDA scientists are out there studying every possible route for contamination. But I know that I talked with you and Harry over the weekend about some of the theories about what happened. And one thing that got me particularly alarmed was realizing that there's a possibility that seed could have been in the ground for 10 years before it sprouted. So what are some of the thoughts about how this contamination happened and why it was so long between when the last test happened and when these plants appeared?
Well, I was reading an article earlier that was saying that the wheat does not stay dormant that long in the ground, and that since it's self-pollinating and most of the pollen doesn't go much farther than a few dozen feet away, that wind pollination is not that likely. So that leaves a couple possibilities that are a little scarier. So this may have been carried into the field somehow by either an animal or by a person, and then popped up unknown to the farmer, because he was growing a different variety of wheat. The strain that Monsanto was testing is a spring-planted variety, and this farmer was planting winter wheat. And that's why when it came up when it did, he was alarmed, and he said, "What is this doing in my field?" He sprayed it, and it didn't die. So I don't know how it got there. I don't believe necessarily that it was wind. It's possible, but probably pretty unlikely. It's most likely that it was carried into the field somehow, either by a person or by an animal.
So when you say by a person, carried it on their shoes, or somebody went and planted it?
Maybe carried it on their shoes. Maybe they did throw it in that field. I mean, either is possible. Which is more likely? I'm not sure. I mean, but the seed is still out there. I know that one of the researchers that was involved in the Monsanto field trials, I believe at the time he was at the University of Idaho, and now he's at Oregon State University. He said that after the field trials were conducted and ended, they were ordered to do one of three things. He said they were ordered to bury, burn, or send back all of the seed used in the trials. I don't know why they would be ordered to bury it necessarily, but either burn or send back. I mean, evidently not all of the seed was sent back or burned or buried. Some of it maybe was left in a sack in some warehouse, or who knows. But the seed did get into that field somehow, and it was probably carried.
Because one of the fears that we were talking about on the weekend, which sounds like it wouldn't have been the case, was that this wheat might have come up been coming up for years, but he hadn't recognized it because he hadn't tried to spray out the field with Roundup, which is how he discovered that this was, in fact, genetically modified wheat. But it sounds like that wasn't a possibility since he was growing a different seasonal wheat than what popped up.
Yeah, that's likely that, or that's unlikely that it was growing there for years, because he was growing winter wheat instead of spring wheat. I don't know how long he was growing winter wheat, but the farmer says that he hasn't had any problems in that field for 9 years. So again, if it was laying dormant, that's, I suppose, a remote possibility, but I still believe that it was probably carried into the field somehow.
Because one of the other issues that I have when I was reading all of Monsanto's claims about the limitations of how this contamination could happen, I'm not sure I feel comfortable believing what Monsanto has to say, and if they actually know, for instance, how long the dormancy period really is or how far the pollen could really blow.
Yeah, they evidently don't. But either way, I think it all plays into their hands, because let's pretend for a minute that the wheat does start to spread somehow. And Monsanto says, oh, we didn't authorize this. We don't know how this happened. Well, in the meantime, a genetically modified plant, the patent of which they hold, is spreading. Essentially, sooner or later, it's going to present these farmers with a fait accompli. They're going to be stuck, and they're going to say, well, now my fields are beginning to become contaminated every year. What are we to do? And Monsanto will probably just shrug its shoulders and say, you could approve it. I mean, it's here now. You know, what do you want to do? It's already there. I don't know how we're going to get it back. Sure, that would be a really sort of irresponsible and publicly bad thing to do for them, but in the end, they would win.
But the other thing that would seem like more typically Monsanto is, well, we're going to sue you for stealing our intellectual property rights.
Well, that's possible. I don't know what's going to happen to this grower. I know I talked to people that were shocked that a grower would admit finding a GMO plant in his field and send it in for confirmation, because it would essentially potentially open him up for litigation if it were found that he had acquired and was using unapproved GMO seeds. But I don't know. I mean, obviously, this guy was really concerned and wanted the truth to come out. I mean, he still remaining anonymous.
I was curious, do you know why he's anonymous?
Well, he's probably really worried about being called out by either the industry or by other growers. I mean, he probably doesn't want to be publicly vilified for what's going on, even if he has, even if he didn't do anything wrong. So, I mean, I don't blame him for that. But eventually, people are going to find out which farmer it was and which field it was.
Well, this morning we're talking about the rogue GMO wheat that was discovered in eastern Oregon this past month. I'm talking with Clinton Lindsay, who is a fifth-generation farmer and food activist and advocate for healthy non-GMO food. He's based in Benton County and works with Green Willow Grains in Tangen, Oregon. And Clinton, you've been involved in the overall struggle against GMO crops for, I guess, a very long time. And I wonder, as an activist, when you see this happen, what do you think is the next step to take?
I think the next step is to, at least on the local level, is to push really hard for our ordinance to be adopted by Benton County. The ordinance I'm talking about is the Food Bill of Rights, one of the provisions of which would ban GMOs from being grown in Benton County. And also, we would support our partners in Jackson County who have been successful in getting a GMO ban on the ballot. I think the urgency of this has been proved both by the recent GMO wheat discovery in eastern Oregon and also because as a reaction to Benton County and Jackson County's efforts, the Oregon State Legislature drafted a bill, Senate Bill 633, which thankfully was defeated in the House, or it was approved by the Senate, and then I don't think it made it out of committee in the House or something like that. But that bill was designed to preempt all local legislation, which would attempt to put any regulation on GMO seeds. And that was as a result of pressure by the industry, no doubt. And the spin they put on it was that we don't want a patchwork of confusing regulation by counties that are unqualified to make agricultural decisions for themselves, which is laughable and insulting. So I take my hat off to any of the legislatures that put a stop to that.
And that's dead.
As far as I know, as of right now, it is dead, yes.
Now, is there a similar legislation that got passed in California in response to some of the anti-GMO county and ordinances that were passed?
I'm not sure. I don't know.
Because I know that the same concerns, Humboldt County and maybe Mendocino County passed anti-GMO ordinances, and I'm not sure how much teeth they have, but I had heard that immediately Monsanto and the other agribusiness chemical companies started agitating for legislation that would override that. And that's a concern all around the country, that when local ordinances are passed to stop GMOs, that then the lobbyists on the state legislative level try to get laws passed that are going to override the local ordinances.
Yeah, but ultimately, we all need to remember that we, the people, are the ones in charge, not these companies. And if we want to maintain our freedom of choice and we want to maintain our food system, we need to put a stop to this type of aggressive biopiracy and biocolonization of our food system. And I mean, if we don't stop it now, this is just a small taste of what's going to come.
Well, let's talk a little bit about why you're so concerned about GMO food and what is it? Because the USDA and Monsanto and all these other agencies are all saying, oh, it's fine. It doesn't hurt human health. There's no problem with it. We shouldn't worry about it. So why are you worried about it?
Well, there's many reasons. Number one, there's an increasing amount of studies that show that it does harm your health and it is a significant health risk. Number two, it eliminates biodiversity. It promotes industrial monocrop agriculture, which is inherently destructive to our sustainable food systems and to our ecosystems. It damages a form of food production, which is, we believe, the only true sustainable way to produce food, and that's a localized organic food system. I mean, we simply can't continue with this industrial global food system. It's too destructive on the soil, on the water, on people's livelihoods, and GMOs and their associated agriculture are right at the core of that damage.
Well, actually, I'm going to be interviewing a woman next week, Judith Schwartz, who wrote a book called Cows Can Save the Planet, and it's a book about soil, and she's talking about all the components of soil that are beyond the chemical agents that soil scientists who work for Monsanto and companies like that see as, you know, what you need in soil, and looking at all the life forms and the multi-diversity of life forms in the soil. So how is, when we go towards a monocrop, pesticide-heavy, fertilizer-heavy kind of agriculture, what are we doing to all these nutrients in the soil, which are really what soil is beyond phosphorus, nitrogen, and potassium?
Well, you're killing the soil's ability to sustain a crop without heavy amounts of pesticides and chemical fertilizers. I mean, we saw this firsthand on our farm back 4 years ago now when we started converting from a conventional grass seed farm over to an organic grain and bean farm. The soil had been farmed chemically for so long that when we stopped using chemicals and began to transition to organic, we had a huge drop in yield and a lot of weed pressure. The soil and the crop rotation hadn't had time to take effect and really provide a beneficial level of biology to the soil that would allow for a healthy crop to grow. And so we began to recognize that what we had on our hands was just an inert medium. The soil had just been pounded to death, and there was no way it could support life, and it takes a long time to build it up again. So what happens to that type of farming when the source of those chemicals and fertilizers is becoming scarcer and more expensive? I mean, most of those chemical fertilizers and chemical pesticides are based on petroleum, which is a finite resource. So that makes that whole system of farming inherently unsustainable.
Also phosphorus, which I guess we're running out of phosphorus, which is mined. I mean, that's something I think people would have a hard time understanding, that the chemical inputs for fertilizer, like phosphorus, are actually, you go and you mine them. It's nothing, it's so far removed from anything organic that it's kind of mind-boggling.
It's important for people to recognize that when they eat food from the industrial agriculture system, they are eating oil. You are literally eating petroleum. If it wasn't for petroleum to pump those fields full of fertilizer, you would not be able to have that food. Most of the world would not be able to have that food. So what happens when those supplies are disrupted? You're going to have a global shakeup of the whole food system. So we can't keep going down that road. We've got to start changing that system, and we have to do it now.
I think another kind of metaphor for this is this fertilizer explosion in Texas a few weeks ago. And we start thinking about how dangerous ammonium nitrate, and I forget the other major nitrous fertilizer, but that these are basically explosives. They were developed as explosives, and then we're putting them in our soil as, quote, fertilizer in a way. I guess they're explosive in the soil as well.
Yeah, if you've ever dumped fertilizer on a field and seen what happens when you put too much on, it literally burns up the field. It is dangerous stuff.
So what do you see as the route to take now? I mean, as we're seeing like the worst case, not the worst case, we're seeing the first case scenario of what the dangers of GMOs are. And this is just the beginning. So I guess a couple things that I'm wondering about is politically, what do you, are you going to do to try to stop this from happening? But the other part of it is, what do you do to that field or once they figure out how many places have been contaminated? Is there a way to clean these fields out and rid them of any kind of GMO properties so that they don't, so that you can go back to growing conventional, so-called conventional crops again?
Well, the most drastic measure to take would be field burning, and I really hope that it doesn't come to that. That's a really scary proposition.
Why is that? I mean, some people actually promote field burning.
What if hundreds of farms are burning half their fields? I mean, that's scary, but that would get a lot of people's attention. I hope it doesn't come to that.
Yeah,
but
that would also really sort of increase our carbon footprint a bit if we did that.
Yeah, I don't really want to see that happen. But, you know, who knows how far it's going to get. So I think immediately we need a lot of political pressure to start happening. And I think the average person that didn't necessarily think they were that involved before needs to recognize how serious this is, and they need to really get on board with pushing against Monsanto and the biotech companies. We've seen a lot of that lately. We saw the March Against Monsanto on Memorial Day weekend happening in, I think, over 40 countries and 400 cities. That's really encouraging. And Connecticut just passed an anti-GMO labeling bill, which is really encouraging. There's some awesome things happening in the public domain that are really exciting to see. I think the movement is gaining steam, and I think people are recognizing more and more how dangerous this is, and they're getting behind us and getting behind the anti-GMO activists.
So what's happening with your local initiative in Benton County?
We have completed the second drafting of our ordinance after we initially fought a court battle with Benton County. Their argument was that our ordinance did not meet the single subject requirement. We argued that it did, that all provisions under the ordinance were germane to the topic of Food Bill of Rights. They argued that it didn't, and they were successful. So we redrafted the ordinance, we simplified much of the language, and we are resubmitting it on the 5th of June. So Wednesday, we will be resubmitting it to the court, and I fully expect us to be back in court arguing against the county and any attorneys they bring in very shortly thereafter.
Well, you're in an interesting county, because I think of Benton County in two ways. On the one hand, it's probably the second or third most liberal county in Oregon, with bases, you know, university town and all that, with Corvallis as the core city. And on the other hand, it's also the home of that liberal university, Oregon State University, which is like one of the bedrocks of agribusiness here in Oregon. So I'm wondering what kind of pressure is coming both ways within the county when they are looking at what could possibly, a measure that could possibly stop any kind of genetically modified crops from being grown in the county.
I expect Oregon State University to be less than enthusiastic, in fact, very antagonistic towards this measure. They do quite a bit of research in the biotech field. They also developed another type of wheat called Clearfield, which is one of, if not the most widely grown wheat in Oregon, which is not genetically modified, but it is chemically mutated under a process that allows it to escape GMO regulation.
So what's the difference between being genetically modified and chemically mutated?
Well, with the genetically modified crop, you have a gene gun that actually blasts the gene from one organism into the genes of another.
It was actually, they send the DNA into the nucleus of the
right.
The cell.
But with this chemical mutagen process, chemical mutation process, it's a little different. They use a chemical to basically combine the RNA with the DNA of another plant, of another organism, creating a new organism, and this allows them to escape GMO regulation. But, however, the company that owns the patent on Clearfield wheat, BASF, another biotech company, still requires you to sign a technology agreement, still requires, they still hold the patent, and they still have the ability to sue you if you don't abide by their technology agreement. So it still has a lot of the bad things associated with GMO agriculture. And Oregon State University receives a significant amount of royalties from this wheat that's grown in Oregon. So they would stand to lose a lot of money if all of this type of agriculture went away. But I would really like to see this university. I'm really proud of Oregon State University in many ways, and I would really love to see them stop trying to do biotech research for GMO crops and focus their energies on sustainable agriculture and really be a leader in that field. They have an opportunity there to really take the lead, and I'd love to see that happen.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Clint Lindsay, who is a food activist in Benton County, and he works with Green Willow Grains in Tangent, which is a organic grain mill, and also one of the, I say, a precursor of another way of doing farming in Benton and Linn County. Well, let's talk a bit more about OSU as a model for sustainable agriculture, because I find there's an interesting thing with OSU, because I first discovered this about the forestry departments, and there's like two buildings that the forestry departments are in, and one of them is the old school clear-cut chemical forestry, and the other one is the sustainable forestry, where they basically developed the strategy for protecting the spotted owl and therefore protecting old-growth forest. And there's a walkway between the two, a skyway between the two buildings, and there's no communication between the two buildings. They're two different worlds. And I wonder, is the same thing true with the Department of Ag, that there's the sustainable school in one building and the conventional school in the other building, and they don't really communicate?
Well, based on my experiences almost 10 years ago with dealing with the canola issue, when we were trying to plant canola before we realized how serious it would be and how serious a risk it would be to the specialty seed industry, we spoke to several scientists at OSU, some of whom were very much opposed to canola and some of whom were very much in favor. And I think that their reasons were scientifically based, but also probably grounded in some level of morality, where they believed that that GMO agriculture was inherently wrong, and some that believed it was the wave of the future. So I don't doubt that the same thing persists in many of the departments at OSU. I mean, you're probably going to find a difference of opinion from any of the professors all the way up to the heads of the departments.
Well, there's the scientist at OSU who was doing the seed test, the testing for the GMO wheat that was found in eastern Oregon. I'm looking for his name right now, but I don't recall.
Well, it's my understanding that Carol Mallory Smith did the testing, but yeah. Bob Zemetra is one of the wheat breeders at OSU.
Right, and he's the one who was at Idaho before.
Right.
And he's basically saying that he believes that even though there's big problems with this occurrence, that we need to have the ability to grow GMO crops in order to deal with climate change and to deal with all the stresses and problems that we are facing in the near future. So what kind of response would you give to that? Because that does seem to be like the party line and a lot at OSU and other agricultural schools.
Yeah, it gets people's attention and it sounds great, but I don't believe it for a minute. I think traditional plant breeding is a very successful method for developing drought-tolerant strains. And don't forget now that all of the GMO research that's been done hasn't developed a drought-tolerant strain. They've developed pesticide-resistant strains or plants that produce their own pesticides. So where are the drought-resistant plants? Well, we don't have them yet. You want the ability to do them later? Well, why aren't you doing them now? That argument doesn't hold any water. I don't believe that guy for a second.
Well, also, there's a rather well-known plant seed breeder in right near you in Philomath, Frank Morton, who was kind of the lightning rod for one of the big anti-GMO battles around sugar beets. And he's somebody who's been breeding seeds that are really acclimated to Willamette Valley for a long time. Why was he so concerned about the GMO beets, and how is all of this affecting his ability to breed local and specifically acclimated seeds for our region?
Well, Frank is a neighbor and a friend, and I have a lot of respect for him. And he was involved in a highly publicized lawsuit brought by the Center for Food Safety against the USDA and Monsanto over their approval of these sugar beets. I believe Syngenta might have also been on there. But basically what they were trying to do was stop them from bringing in these plants because it would negatively affect the entire specialty seed industry. And we saw in 2006, after they brought it in, within 3 years, over 95% of the sugar beet seed being grown in the Willamette Valley is genetically modified now. So it highlights how quickly this can move in and take over a whole industry if given the green light. And Frank was really concerned about that. I think he's one of the only, if not the only, organic vegetable seed grower that is a member of the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association. In the Willamette Valley Specialty Seed Association, you've got conventional sugar beet growers. You had GMO sugar beet growers, you had organic vegetable seed growers, conventional vegetable seed growers, and then when this happened, it created deep divides in that organization between people that wanted it and people that did not. But there was a lot of pressure from the industry that basically said to the growers, either get on board with this technology or get out of the business because it's coming. And we saw how quickly it took over. It only took a few years.
So what's happening with Frank now? He's still developing seeds as far as I know.
Yeah, Frank is still breeding seeds, and his specialty is breeding seeds for fresh market producers of vegetables. And he grows heirloom varieties, open pollinator varieties, a lot of different varieties that are acclimatized to the Willamette Valley. And any type of seed that would come in and potentially cross with his pure strains and would be a serious detriment to his business. And he recognized that, and that's why he fought so hard against it. And they kept winning basically battles, but then Monsanto and the industry would keep getting end-arounds and keep planting these things.
So with sugar beet, didn't they do something where they flag where the GMO sugar beets are being grown, and supposedly that's going to protect Frank and the other specialty seed growers from contamination?
Well, the specialty seed industry, the association has a pinning system where, and this used to be on the wall in the extension office in Albany where you could go and look at it, and it was a big map of the valley. And any place you were growing a plant that could potentially cross with another within this whole group of vegetables that these guys grow, you had to pin it, and it was based on seniority and first come, first serve. So you could go in and see, oh, 5 miles from me, there are, you know, some beta beets being grown, and 10 miles down the road, there are some Swiss chard. And you knew that if you were going to grow a crop that could cross with those, if you were within a few miles of them, you couldn't plant it if that pin was already there. So that was a system that worked for them for a long time. But then when you had the sugar beet growers coming in with the GMO plants, then you know you started to see this divide happening. And now I believe the pinning map is not on public display anymore and is only available to either members of the association, or it's just not something that anybody can go and look at anymore. So this shows how worried they are about letting just anybody know who's growing what where. And I know that there was a somebody stated from inside the industry that they were afraid of letting people know where the GMO sugar beet fields were because they were afraid of eco-terrorists.
Well, how does that, but the whole point of being, if you believe that the seeds aren't going to blow further than what the buffer zones are, what is the point of having a pinning map if people can't find out where certain crops are grown so that they know where the buffers are and where the boundaries are?
Well, it's just for the use of the growers, I would expect. But this, again, highlights just how fragile the whole system is and what a load. It's just a complete crock to suggest that these seeds aren't going to get out and it's not going to spread somehow. Now, sugar beets are wind pollinated. Wheat is not. So it's much more likely for the pollen to spread into a neighbor's field from sugar beets. But there's 100 other ways it could spread, falling outside of a truck. A sack has a leak in it that's being taken to market. Somebody gets some on their shoes, gets some on the tires of a tractor. Who knows? They're driving down the road and it starts coming up on the side of that road. There's so many different ways the seed can spread. Seed wants to spread. Seed is really good at spreading.
That's what its mission is.
Yes.
Is to germinate. Well, actually, there was a case, at least one case of organic compost that was contaminated with GMO sugar beets, as I recall, I think in Philomath. And that was one of the arguments that was used in Frank's case for how they could not control and curtail the spread of GMO sugar beets.
Yeah, again, it just shows why would you want to let out this plant that can find a thousand ways to spread when you can't say conclusively that it's safe. You can't say conclusively that it's not going to destroy this other industry. You're telling us it's going to coexist. What does that mean to you? You define coexistence for me. You, as the industry, tell me what that means to you. Does that mean that these two industries can exist side by side without ever affecting the other? That is ridiculous that they would make that claim. And now we know that it's completely false.
Well, one of the worst scenarios I think that people have been imagining since the news of the GMO wheat in Eastern Oregon came out is that this is the end of food as we know it. Is that a concern for you, or do you think that we have a way to fight back?
I think that's a pretty drastic. I think if we made that claim, we might as well just give up now and go start spooning GMO corn right into our mouths. I don't believe that, but I do believe that it is time to wake up, get serious, fight this. You know, stop sitting on the sidelines, get involved. I mean, this is our food we're talking about. This isn't sugar. This isn't, you know, sugar beets. This is wheat. we need to get serious now.
Well, just one last thing. Let's talk about wheat and another way of growing wheat, and that's one of the things that you're involved with right now. Actually, it was marketing the wheat that's being grown in a different way in the Willamette Valley. So let's talk a bit about Green Willow Grains and how you're doing things differently than so much of the rest of wheat farmers and grain farmers in Oregon.
Well, when we started doing this, the way the system was set up for selling grain essentially was that you sold as much as you could on the international commodity market. Anything you had left over, you would maybe ship regionally to seed companies that wanted it. And then if you had any left over, you'd maybe let a little go locally. Well, we wanted to flip that pyramid over and get as much into the local food system as possible, as much as the market would bear and that our marketing efforts would allow. And then if we had any left over, then start looking a little farther afield, like regionally first and finally nationally. And then if we had any left over that we needed to move, we'd sell it internationally. And that's worked really well for us so far. And I think that we've been expanding our markets every year.
And what kind of wheat? What kind of grains are you growing?
Well, right now we grow hard red wheat, soft white wheat, several varieties of soft white wheat. We grow emmer, spelt, rye, buckwheat, barley, triticale, flax.
Oats
are really big for us right now. We grow hullus oats. So we're growing all those right now, and most of those are being, the bulk of which is being sold locally.
Actually, garbanzo beans, too.
We occasionally have garbanzo beans.
We're filming you planting them last week.
Yeah, beans are real dicey in the valley. You plant them when you can, but they need a very specific weather pattern in order to succeed. So
your markets are growing locally?
Absolutely, every year.
Now, just one last thing, because this is an interesting irony. We've talked in the past on the show about Oregon Grains bread, which was a featured bread of Nature Bakes line, and it was the 100-mile bread, all baked with grains from your farm. And then Dave's Killer Bread took it over, and Dave's Killer Bread's going national. So how does that leave you when you are committed to growing for a local market and one of your main customers decides to start going national?
Well, they've pulled back from marketing Oregon Grains bread pretty far afield, and we still supply them with a significant amount of wheat, oats, and flax for that bread. But for example, it's not in the First Alternative Co-op in Corvallis anymore. I mean, when Dave's Killer Bread merged with Nature Bake and they changed the label on the Oregon Grains bread from Nature Bake to Dave's Killer Bread, I don't see it in as many places anymore. It's up in Portland at all the stores that I'm used to seeing it at, but not down in farther in the valley.
Actually, not at New Seasons anymore. It's harder to come by, and they also interestingly stopped using your local honey.
Yeah,
for vegan reasons, I guess.
For vegan reasons, yeah, they were using Olson's honey from Albany, but they wanted it to be vegan, so they couldn't do that anymore.
And I guess the other things that are interesting is that the big things that aren't local in that bread are the gluten. They add gluten, which is probably not good for people who are wanting to eat gluten-free.
Well, that's why it's so soft and spongy.
Right. And then also sugar. So it's the two items in there that might be questionable in the eyes of somebody who's really concerned about very healthy eating. Well, this has been, it's been really good to talk with you, Clint. And we will keep posted on the developments of both this latest, the GMO scandal that's becoming known, and also what's going on in Greenwell Farms and Stafford Sea Farms. I think it's a really important story to tell. So thanks a whole lot for joining us.
Thanks, Barbara.
And we've been talking this morning with farmer and anti-GMO activist Clint Lindsay, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, my guest is Judith Schwartz, author of Cows Save the Planet, which is about what's really in our soil and what really needs to be there in order to save the planet and protect us from climate change. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Michael McDade. We're going to go out with some music by the band. Thanks for listening.
Corn in the fields, listen to the rice when the wind blows across the water. King harvest is surely come. I work for the union, 'cause she's so good to me.
You are listening to KBOO FM, 90.7 Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Dr. Robert Amajoyi and the Northwest Center for Colorectal Health, LLC, providing screening colonoscopy to help prevent colorectal cancer, as well as minimally invasive management of colorectal disease. Offices in Portland and Milwaukee. Detailed information at 503-216-5380 or nwcch.com. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
Wednesdays in Portland are a little more festive these days, thanks to Creative Collaborations and Hump Day PDX. Hump Day PDX is a street festival in Southeast Portland, featuring the live music and art exhibits of creative entrepreneurs who are living on the streets. There are also family activities to enjoy, food, and a beer garden, all organized by Creative Collaborations in support of struggling artists and in an effort to stimulate the local neighborhood economy as well. Hump Day PDX is June 12th from 6 to 10 p.m. and every second Wednesday of the month thereafter at Southeast 9th and Belmont in Portland. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Temple Grandin, is one of the world's most accomplished and well-known adults with autism. A professor of animal science at Colorado State University, she is the author of several best-selling books and was the subject of the HBO movie based on her life, starring Claire Danes. She's here on Health Watch today to talk about her new book, The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum, a cutting-edge account of the latest science of autism. Welcome to Health Watch, Temple Grandin.
It's great to be here.
So at the beginning of The Autistic Brain, Temple, you talk about how there's been a big shift in the conceptualization of autism from one that was primarily looked at as psychoanalytic and now is moving much more into biology. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, you see, the autistic diagnoses of things like autism and ADHD, depression, anxiety, all of these different things, they are behavioral profiles. There's no lab tests, you know, to go in for these things. So basically, it's behavioral profiles. And over the last few decades, the American Psychiatric Association has, changed the behavioral profiles as there was new knowledge. And we outline how that has changed. In fact, autism having some changes. They're going to take out Asperger's, which is the mild autism with no speech delay, and replace it with social communication disorder. Well, I think that has to do with trying to cut back services because it's still on the autism spectrum. You know, there's no black and white dividing line between socially awkward, geeky, and nerdy and having autism. And see, a little bit of that autistic trait can give you an advantage, you know, because half of Silicon Valley probably has some autism, and you wouldn't have any radio stations to talk on if you didn't have, people with at least a little bit of autism that were more interested in engineering than in being social.
And there's been a lot of controversy over the definition of what autism is over the decades. And you talk a little bit about how you were lucky to be born when you were in the various shifting time periods of the autism definition. Can you talk a little bit about your mother?
I was born 10 years before things got really bad on blaming mothers for autism. That was the Bettelheim era. Fortunately, my mother didn't get subjected to the absolute worst of that. and I got into very good early intervention through a referral from a neurologist. I didn't go to a psychiatrist when I was a little tiny kid, 2.5 years old, and I had no speech. And I can't emphasize enough, if you have a young 2-year-old or 3-year-old that's not talking, worst thing you can do is nothing. You have got to get this kid into early intervention. And if you're somewhere where there's no services, you get some grandmothers, you get some students, you've got to work with this kid. You got to play games with them, teaching, turn-taking, saying words. You've got to interact with them.
And you, so your mother was really ahead of her time, in a sense.
Yes, she was, very, very definitely. I mean, autism is a very big spectrum. At one end of the spectrum, you got famous artists. I think Van Gogh had a lot of autistic traits. You got Einstein, who had no speech until age 3. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got people that remain nonverbal that are extremely handicapped. So you've got this word autism that covers a very, very large spectrum. And I get very concerned about the kids that are more like me, sort of not getting their abilities developed. And, you know, people on the spectrum, and this is another chapter of the Autistic Brain book, tend to have uneven skills. Good at one thing, bad at something else. Like I was really super good at art. Another kid may be good at math but have problems with reading. Another kid's good at writing. We've got to build up on the thing that they're good at so they can turn it into a career.
So that seems like a really intuitive approach, but a lot of times people actually do the opposite. They focus on shoring up the deficiencies rather than focusing on the strengths. And well, you give a good example of one of your teachers who you really admired but also made this mistake.
Well, yeah, he bashed away on algebra when we should have gone to geometry and trig, because there's a lot of visual thinkers that can't do algebra, but they can do geometry and trig. Now, I'm not suggesting that we totally do nothing for deficit. You know, we have to do something. But, you know, we tend to just whack away at the deficits and not do anything to build up the strength. I've heard sad cases where a child was doing badly in math, and so they took away band practice so he could do an extra period of math. Well, band practice is the thing the kid loved and made school worthwhile to him. You don't take away band practice.
And you talk a lot in the Autistic Brain also about the danger.